Well, it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. And Uncle Dennis suggests that you have a pencil and paper handy so that if something comes up that you might want to write down some information that you might want to, you know, deal with later, you'll have a record of what happened and why and, you know, might do something about it. Just want to let you know that the latest Earth First Journal is now available in digital format. It's the winter edition, Brigid 2014. I know it's spring, but anyway, you can go online and check that out at www.earthfirstjournal.org. We're excited to share the printed copies of the Earth First Journal in digital format. Now we can more easily keep Luddites and eco-techies across the globe informed and inspired to defend our Earth from corporate domination and industrial contamination. Keep folks plugged in. Your support is needed. I knew we'd get to that. If you're not currently an Earth First Journal subscriber, give a read to our latest issue online. And if you like what you see, consider sending us some love. Your support will help print and mail the next issue, the spring edition, Beltane 2014, available in May. $7,000 is needed to get that to everybody. So, subscribe, donate, do whatever you can to get the Earth First Journal out. If you go to PayPal, the email address is collective@earthfirstjournal.org. And if you want to mail your donations, send them to the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 964, Lake Worth, Florida, 33460. And you can find out all this information and more at www.earthfirstjournal.org. Once again, and coming up quickly, the No Pipelines Training Camp, April 4th through the 6th. Rising Tide is organizing a convergence weekend, April 4th, 5th, and 6th, up in Vancouver, British Columbia. You'll have to cross the border to get to this. Weekend will be for mass movement trainings focused on building resistance across our different organizing spaces to fight extreme energy expansion and its numerous resulting oppressions across Turtle Island. They're going to have workshops, direct action training, warrior societies, shaping conditions for grassroots revolts, planning and preparation for actions, security culture, counter-surveillance, how to stop a goddamn pipeline, fundraising for radicals, legal rights, indigenous solidarity, affinity group organizing, everything you need to know. If you want to find out where and how this is happening, go to risingtide604, that's email address, risingtide604@riseup.net. That's risingtide604@riseup.net. This camp is put on by Rising Tide Vancouver and the Coast Salish Territories. Alameda Creek news. Alameda Creek cleanup is coming up in April 19th. Help the Alameda Creek Alliance clean our adopt-a-spot at the bottom of the Niles Canyon on Saturday, April 19th. We will also be pulling invasive ivy off of trees in the riparian corridor. Contact Ralph@AlamedaCreek.org for more information. That's Ralph@AlamedaCreek.org for more information. And a little news about Alameda Creek. Fish passage barrier removed from Arroyo de Laguna near Castlewood Golf Course. Zone 7 Water Agency has removed a failing in-stream concrete structure from Arroyo de la Laguna at the Castlewood Country Club pedestrian crossing in Pleasanton, California. The obsolete structure was removed because it was a flood and public safety hazard, but it was also a potentially significant migration barrier for fish. This was the 11th fish barrier removal from Alameda Creek and its tributaries since 2003. Between now and 2017, there will be 9 more fish passage projects being planned to remove barriers to provide fish or to provide fish ladders in the watershed. More information at www.alamedacreek.org. And unfortunately, this is the 25th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez tragedy. In this story written by Marcy Kiever, Oceans and Vessels Program Director for Friends of the Earth. Shortly after midnight on March 24th, 1989, the oil tanker Exxon Valdez struck Bly Reef in Prince William Sound, Alaska. The tanker spilled at least 11 million gallons of crude oil that coated 1,300 miles of Alaskan coastline. The damage to fish, marine birds, and resource-dependent communities surrounding Prince William Sound was beyond and is beyond repair. 2.5 decades and $2.1 billion in cleanup costs later, the remains of this oil still persist on Alaskan beaches and on the Psyche. It's a story that's played out again and again across the country with the BP's Deepwater Horizon disaster just 4 years ago, the Kalamazoo River tar sands pipeline in spill in Michigan a few months later, numerous explosions on oil trains carrying dangerous oil from Canada and the U.S., and just this last Saturday, a ship hit an oil barge in Texas, spilling 168,000 gallons of oil near an important shorebird habitat. The transport of these dirty fuels has and always will be extremely dangerous to the environment and surrounding communities. Since 1975, the Energy Policy and Conservation Act has prohibited oil companies from exporting domestic crude oil overseas, capping the market on heavy crude oil and limiting transport to domestic lands and waters. But after remarks in support of reconsidering the ban by U.S. Energy Secretary Ernst Moniz, for four U.S. oil refiners, the American Petroleum Institute, and their friends of Congress have begun lobbying to lift the ban. We need this ban on crude oil exports to limit our global fossil fuel consumption and the resulting climate impacts, and to prevent dangerous accidents that will inevitably result from the transport of these dirty fuels. Let's use the 25th anniversary of the tragic Exxon Valdez disaster to remind the Obama administration how important the ban is. Increased exports of these dirty, dangerous fossil fuels would have devastating impacts on our lands, rivers, oceans, public health, and climate change. Keep these dirty fuels in the ground, protect our country and the world from more devastating oil spill disasters, and help turn the tide on climate change by supporting real, clean energy solutions. For more information, go to www.foe.org. That's the Friends of the Earth website, www.foe.org. And Marcellus Shale Earth First halts Anadarko hydrofracking operation in the Teodotan State Forest. And the story from Marcellus Shale Earth First, as found on the Earth First Newswire. We turn to Waterville, Pennsylvania. In the pre-dawn hours, activists with Marcellus Shale Earth First, Pennsylvania residents and students took action to halt Anadarko's hydraulic fracturing operations in the Teodotan State Forest. Four protesters blocked the only access road to a well pad by locking themselves to barrels of concrete, preventing the workers from entering the site. They were later arrested. Dozens more activists held a rally in Anadarko's corporate offices in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. The activists demanded an immediate halt to all plans for new drilling on Pennsylvania's public lands. Michael Badges Canning, a retired schoolteacher from Butler County, said, "The public lands of Pennsylvania belong to all Pennsylvanians. It is my obligation as a resident of the Commonwealth and a grandparent to protect our wild heritage, our pristine waters, and the natural beauty for my grandchildren, Doe and Lachlan." Governor Corbett has recently issued an executive order to open Pennsylvania's remaining public lands for hydraulic fracturing. This includes state forests that have been off-limits to gas companies since 2010, when then-Governor Ed Rendell declared a moratorium on new leases. The moratorium came in the wake of a Pennsylvania DCNR study that concluded no remaining state-owned lands were suitable for oil and gas development without significant surface disruptions. Corbett's move to lift the multi-year ban ignores the negative effect that new leases will have on Pennsylvania's most ecologically sensitive forests, including those where species are at risk. Anadarko's proposed development in the Clarence Moore Tract, part of the Loyal Sauk Forest, has become the center of a grassroots campaign to defend Pennsylvania's last remaining wild places. Local residents packed DCNR hearings to protest Anadarko's plans, leading to the ousting of former DCNR Secretary Richard Allen. According to Pennsylvania DEP's Oil and Gas Compliance Report, Anadarko has been cited with nearly 250 violations over the past 5 years, ranking the company in the top 3% of violators statewide. Danielle Dietrich of the Marcellus Shale Earth First said, "As a lifelong resident of Pennsylvania, I feel a morally responsibility to protect my home from the malicious onslaught of an industry with a track record of environmental degradation and human rights violations. Our governor's complicity has proven he is an industry pawn who can ignore the words of our state constitution and the desires of those who he is supposed to represent. Residents of Pennsylvania have shown that they will not give up their wild places without a fight. In July of 2012, nearly 100 activists with Marcellus Shale Earth First forced a 70-foot-tall EQT hydrofracking drill rig to suspend operations for 12 hours in the Moshannon State Forest. Last fall, students from around the country rallied with Allegheny County residents in Pittsburgh to oppose County Executive Rich Fitzgerald's plan to open up county parks to hydrofracking. Marcellus Shale Earth First has vowed to prevent any new shale gas development in the Loyal Sock State Forest. You can go to MarcellusShaleEarthFirst.org to find out more information about that. Meanwhile, out in the Midwest, another megalode has been stopped and turned back by the Cheyenne River Sioux. In this story by Joy Braun of Censored News, as found on the Earth First Newswire. In the windy cold of the night, Unsamaka warriors from the Cheyenne River stood their ground to have Cheyenne River Sioux tribe's megalode law enforced on March 25th. It was reported about 6 p.m. that evening that a megalode was parked at the Cheyenne River Sioux Motel. Several people checked on the load and at first thought that they would confront the driver the following morning, as they knew he was probably in his room and his South Dakota permit wouldn't allow him to move during the evening hours. However, a young warrior, Joseph White Eyes, saw the truck on his way home from work and told his wife to whip into the parking lot, and he decided he would make a stand to watch over the load. White Eyes called the Cheyenne River Police, but at first the police refused to contact the driver or allow anyone else to contact the driver at the motel. The police left, and White Eyes was posting updates on the Facebook. Joy Braun heard about the situation at the motel, and she decided she would go and support this young warrior and try and get the megalode off the reservation. She bundled up in blankets and parked herself in front of the truck while White Eyes sat under the bumper of the truck in front of the wheels, refusing to move until the truck was escorted off the reservation. Other members of the tribe started showing up to show their support and also refused to leave until the truck was removed from the reservation. CRS Council Representative Robin LeBeau showed up to act as a mediator for the group between the truck driver and tribal government. She told the chairman of the tribe and the vice chair of the tribe that she was not in charge, but just acting as a mediator. The group of protesters asked her to do this and told her their demands of removing the truck from reservation boundaries and enforcing our megalode laws. Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe Chairman Keckler was reached, and he ordered the police to remove the megalode from reservation boundaries and to have it go back the way it came. The group was happy to see Chairman Heckler step up for the cause against the oil companies and stand up for our tribal sovereignty. The Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe Police escorted the truck off the reservation with two patrol cars back across the Mississippi at night with lights to warn drivers that this was a dangerous load. The protesters were happy, and Akishas and Lilies, as the truck left the parking lot. And sabotage has occurred at a bobcat farm in this story from Bite Back, as found on the Earth First Newswire. In the early morning hours of March the 7th, anonymous individuals breached the property lines of Fraser Fur Farm, a target of anti-fur activists and compassionate individuals for nearly a quarter century. Our motives were born of a fierce love for wildlife and a torn heart forced to watch as bobcats and other wild creatures have been made to endure intense confinement and the inevitable fate of a horrendous death at the hands of those who seek to profit from their skins. Fur farming is a truly despicable industry, and the neck-breaking, rib-cage-stomping, anal electrocutions and gas chambers must be put to an end by all those with love and courage in their hearts. After entering the compound, we quickly discovered various methods of security deterrence, including motion sensor floodlights, fortified fencing, active guard dogs, and two houses on site, one of which was less than 100 feet from the bobcat pens, which were our target. Nonetheless, our task was to disrupt as best we could the fate of those which remained awaits these fur-bearing animals. Upon entering the bobcat enclosures, we viewed these magnificent creatures reduced to market commodities and felt shame that such humans would bestow an existence like this. Some cowered on towards the backs of their cages. Others slowly inched toward us, curious as to the motives of these late-night visitors, and still others quickly began thrashing about, violently throwing their bodies as a clear expression of the torment inherent in their captivity. Now is our time to lend a hand toward their freedom and return to the wild. We quickly began the process of destroying all breeding records. This nonviolent act is to ensure the loss of irreplaceable genetic lines, rendering the breeding stock of a given fur-bearing business lost. It is with tremendous sadness in our hearts that despite our best efforts, cages were unable to be opened before being run off site by awoken residents. This act was meant not to inflict violence against those who profit from this business or to install fear and terror in a world already rife with such things, but simply as a gesture of solidarity and love toward those trapped in cages. We and all others born with enduring compassion in their hearts will continue to risk freedom in service to others so long as captivity and violence is the status quo. We hope and pray for a day when those who reap profits at the expense of all that is sacred will be made to stop the violence until the last fur farm meets its end. For all those human and non-human continuing to struggle for dignity and peace on occupied land. And here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field. This past week was a really good one for wild buffalo. No hunting has taken place since March 16th, so it seems that this overlong late-season hunt is finally over, and the buffalo seem to know. The Gardner Basin near Yellowstone's north boundary is currently teeming with hundreds of wild migratory buffalo. Patrols, many locals, and even some government agents have been ecstatic. From the high hills of Eagle Creek all the way north to the Yellowstone River to Cutler Meadows, wild buffalo are roaming everywhere, and they are being left alone. It is hard to put into words how wonderful it is to see these gentle giants using this landscape without danger from traps, bullets, or horsemen. We give deep, heartfelt thanks to you because this awesome sight is a direct result of 17 years of the Buffalo Field Campaign's hard work, made possible by your unrelenting support, and the recent court ruling that gave wild buffalo the right to access habitat in the Gardner Basin. We now bear witness to the direct results of these efforts, and though temporary, it is awesome to behold. These are the moments we live and work for. Spring is beginning to take hold in the Gardner Basin. Buffalo, finally able to stretch their migratory legs, are feeling the pull of the warming tide and friskily expressing themselves. We have been honored to spend time with them as they romp and play, run for the fun of it, kick up the dust, soak up the sun, and enjoy the first new shoots of spring grasses. Massive bull bison have joined the Gardner Basin party as well. It's been such an intense pleasure to see these enormous shaggy bulls make appearances. It seemed that for most of the long winter, bulls had been taken out early by hunters while others were laying low out of sight. Sometimes it's hard to believe that these big boys are real. They're such an impressive sight and seem to command respect everywhere they go. We are awestruck by them. In the Hebgen Basin, about 30 miles to the southwest of Gardner as the raven flies, and a few thousand feet higher in elevation, snows are still deep, though the ground is starting to open up. Some family groups are beginning to make their way to Horse Butte. Calving season is just a few weeks away, and the buffalo seek out the south-facing slopes that offer early grass and perhaps other plants the buffalo are aware that aid in birthing. Patrols are busy morning through night monitoring the buffalo and helping to warn traffic as they migrate through the basin, having to cross Highway 191. Winter hasn't given up her cold grip here. The next few weeks will be trying times for the buffalo that made it through. They need all the ease and food they can find. For now, nature is the only one in charge, and buffalo roam with a little freedom. Participate in the Buffalo Field Campaign's program. If you have ever dreamed of standing with buffalo and fighting for their rights to be wild, now is the time. Buffalo Field Campaign is in need of caring people to make this sacred sacrifice to help the buffalo. Buffalo Field Campaign invites you to join us on the front lines here on the edge of the world's first national park to defend America's last wild migratory buffalo. We need more people to stand with us and protect the buffalo. Please, if you have ever thought about coming out, we need the help right now until the end of May. Buffalo Field Campaign provides a room, board, gear, and training while the wildlife and wildlands provide incredible inspiration. Buffalo Field Campaign is also looking for at least 6 people to help us spread the word to save the herds this summer. Buffalo Field Campaign is looking for help from June through the first week of September. The positions would entail working in our Buffalo Museum in West Yellowstone, Montana, tabling and camping inside Yellowstone National Park, and going to music festivals and summer events. Each week we will have you doing a different job, so you would not be stuck doing one thing the whole summer. If spending your summer in the Yellowstone ecosystem and helping save the buffalo is something that interests you, please contact the Buffalo Field Campaign. They promise this will be a summer you will never forget. You can contact the Buffalo Field Campaign through their website, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. There you can find their volunteer application and information, more information about volunteering and how you go about doing it. You could also send a donation to the Buffalo Field Campaign at P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana. Their zip code 59758. Or you could give them a call at 406-646-0070. Once again, the webpage, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And please remember that the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And Washington State allowed logging on a plateau above the landslide. In this story by Mike Baker, Ken Armstrong, and Hal Burton of the Seattle Times. The plateau above the soggy hillside that gave way last Saturday has been logged for almost a century, with hundreds of acres of softwoods cut and hauled away, according to state records. But in recent decades, as the slope has become more unstable, scientists have increasingly challenged the timber harvest, with some even warning of possible calamity. The state, though, has continued to allow logging on the plateau, although it has imposed restrictions at least twice since the 1980s. The remnant of one clear-cut operation is visible on aerial photographs of Saturday's monstrous mudslide. A triangle of 7.5 acres in the shape of a pie slice can be seen atop the destruction, its tip just cutting into where the hill collapsed. Multiple factors can contribute to a slide. With the hill that caved in over the weekend, geologists have pointed to the Still Guamish River's erosion of the hill's base or toe, but logging can also play a role in instigating or intensifying a slide by increasing the amount of water seeping into an unstable zone, according to an analysis of the watershed submitted to the State Department of Natural Resources. In May of 1988, when a private landowner, Summit Timber, received approval to begin logging above the slope, scientists raised alarms about the removal of trees that intercept or absorb so much water, according to documents obtained by the Seattle Times. Paul Kennard, a geologist for the Tulalip tribes, warned regulators that harvesting holds the potential for a massive and catastrophic failure of the entire hill slope. Others echoed his concerns. Noel Wolf, a hydrologist who worked for the state, wrote that timber harvesting could possibly cause what is likely an inevitable event to occur sooner. And Pat Stevenson, an environmental biologist for the Still Guamish tribe, cited the potential for massive failure similar to a slide that occurred in 1967. The agency that issued the permit, the Washington Department of Natural Resources, responded to the concerns by assembling a team of geologists and hydrologists to study the harvest potential impact on landslides. Lee Benda, a geologist with the University of Washington, wrote a report that said harvesting can increase soil water in the order of 20% to 35%, with the impact lasting 16 to 27 years until new trees matured. Benda looked at past slides on the hill and found they occurred within 5 to 10 years of previous harvests. In August of 1988, the DNR issued a stop work order putting Summit Timber's logging operation on temporary hold. 1988 was maybe the first time that we were getting serious as to what we should do or should not do in terms of logging and road construction around those things, said Matt Bernego, at that time a DNR geologist. A week after the stop work order, a Summit representative wrote to the Washington Department of Natural Resources saying $750,000 to $1 million worth of timber was at stake. He listed alternate steps that could be taken to lessen the risks of a slide. For example, having the state relocate the channel of this Stillaguamish River that was cutting into the hill's base. I can only conclude that the real issue here is not slides and water quality, but timber cutting, he wrote. Although records indicate that at least 300 acres were harvested on the plateau in the late 1980s, the state moved to prevent Summit Timber from clear-cutting 48 acres considered most likely to discharge water down the slope. Mapping out the areas most likely to feed water into unstable terrain is fraught with uncertainty, wrote one geologist who studied this landslide zone in the 1990s. Kennard, who now works as the geomorphologist at the National Park Service, said the 1988 application was contentious because the state rarely objected to proposed harvests. Getting Washington Department of Natural Resources to limit the cut's scope was no small task, he said. That was considered kind of a big victory, Kennard said. Concerns about landslides surfaced again in 2004 when property owner Grandy Lake applied for a permit to clear a 15-acre tract near the plateau's edge. The state rejected the application, saying some of the proposed logging fell within a sensitive area that could feed water into the slope. Working in that zone would require years of intensive monitoring of precipitation and groundwater. Grandy Lake revised its application, halving the proposed harvest to avoid the sensitive zone. The final plan, a clear-cut shape like a right triangle, had an eastern border that abutted the area. The state approved Grandy Lake's application while attaching conditions including all yarding and log hauling activities will cease at the onset of heavy or steady rain and will not resume until the rain has subsided for at least 24 hours. That harvesting of that area was finished in August of 2005. In January 2006, a large slide hit and diverted the Stillaguamish River. And I might add that they are still finding, but in many cases not recovering bodies from that landslide. And a federal judge has upheld the Piatt Bighorn sheep protections in this story by Rocky Barker in the Idaho Statesman, as found on the Earth First Newswire. A federal judge has upheld the decision of the Piatt National Forest to close 70% of the forest to domestic sheep grazing to protect wild bighorn sheep. U.S. Ninth Circuit Judge Wallace Tashima denied a motion by the Idaho Wool Growers Association to overturn a 2010 decision by Piatt National Forest Supervisor Suzanne Rainville aimed at separating domestic and bighorn sheep. Tashima ruled the Forest Service had followed the preponderance of evidence that domestic sheep carry diseases to the wild sheep populations. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is produced every Thursday right here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. We want to thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to a rebroadcast of this show, tune in tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, or listen live at www.freakradio.org. Or if you're living in Moscow, Idaho, you can tune in Monday nights at 9:30 to KRFP 90.3 FM, their new high-power frequency. Or you could go to radioforall.net to download a podcast or listen there. Radioforall.net, unfortunately, is currently having severe economic problems. They've gotten more than broke. Their servers have gotten old and aged, and they've been kicked out of their site where they were working. Fortunately, donations have been helping them in the last few days, and their servers are currently up and running, but they still need work. If folks would go to radioforall.net in the upper right-hand corner, find a place to donate, then please help out radioforall.net. It's the way that we, the independent radio broadcasters, get our programs out to other broadcasters and to you. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening, and I want to remind you that Free Radio Santa Cruz is a do-it-yourself radio project. Please help support Free Radio Santa Cruz. Go to our webpage at www.freakradio.org to find out how to support us. Once again, thank you for listening.